From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a kind of shorthand that many Americans use to describe the justices of the Supreme Court, and it's usually political. They get put in camps. They're right or left or moderate. And it's an easy way to make sense of the rulings and the votes, but it's too easy, says legal scholar Lawrence Tribe. Tribe has written a book that explains the Supreme Court under Chief Justice John Roberts. And he says if you just look at politics, you squeeze out some crucial elements that are also at play in the decisions rendered by the highest court, among them legitimacy and uncertainty. Lawrence Tribe will join us today to talk about his book that explores the Roberts Court and how it may be revising the meaning of the Constitution. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In his new book, the acclaimed legal scholar Lawrence Tribe admits the U.S. Supreme Court can seem mysterious and secretive, its decisions complex, which may explain why observers usually turn to ideology or politics as a way of interpreting the rulings or the votes. But in the book, Tribe resists that. He doesn't break down the Roberts Court into left or right camps or into legal philosophies. In fact, Tribe says the role of politics or even personality is overstated. And he believes it doesn't capture how the court really works because it doesn't capture how the justices actually think about their work or their position on the court. The justices, he says, are moved by a dizzying array of considerations, history and precedent, and legitimacy, and even uncertainty. This is an important theme in the book. Today in the program, Lawrence Tribe is joining us. His book is called Uncertain Justice, The Roberts Court and the Constitution. And we invite you to join us. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'd also like to hear from those of you on Facebook and on Twitter. Lawrence Tribe teaches constitutional law at Harvard Law School. He's argued dozens of cases before the Supreme Court, including the first argument in Bush v. Gore. His former students, we should point out, include President Barack Obama, Chief Justice John Roberts, and Justice Elena Kagan, along, I should also say Joshua Matz is his co-author in the book, and Professor Tribe is joining us today from a studio in New York City. Lawrence Tribe, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Great to be with you, Doug.
Well, I guess I wanted to begin by asking you what got you thinking about doing a book like this. I mean, it seems like on some level, I get a sense early on in the book that the book is kind of a response to what you see as a kind of misunderstanding about the way court works.
Yeah, that's a lot of it. I mean, I thought as John Roberts embarks on his 10th year as Chief Justice that the court he has led and the people who need to understand what it's doing to their lives really could use a more thoughtful and open-minded look in terms of underlying constitutional ideas and not just personal caricatures than it typically gets at the end of each term. And I thought that it was important to do that without a lot of legal jargon and mumbo-jumbo in ways that, people could enjoy. I mean, there are a lot of funny things about the court, even though what it does is dead serious. And I worked with the most talented student I've had in the last several years, who is about to start a clerkship with Justice Anthony Kennedy, right. Joshua Matz, to produce a book like that. And I hope we succeeded. Doris Kearns Goodwin says it's irresistible. Jeff Toobin loves it. Ted Olson, who's on the political right, calls it superb and even-handed. I feel complimented by that, but that's just because I want everybody to read this book. I don't think it should be for experts alone.
A theme in the book is expressed very early on where you write that an effort to understand the Roberts Court, you say, must reckon with more than just its results. You say that their opinions open this window into their hearts and minds. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I think a good illustration is what the court did this year in a couple of cases that got lots of coverage because of their unanimity. The case up striking down the 35-foot buffer zone around abortion clinics by a vote of 9-0, and the case striking down the president's recess appointments by a vote of 9-0 actually opened up dramatic windows into the differences between five members of the court and four others, all of whom went along with the result but had very different forms of analysis. In the recess appointment case, four justices, led by Justice Scalia, thought that no president should be able to appoint anybody during an intra-session recess, only between sessions of Congress, and read the Constitution and its whole history to mean that you could only use recess appointments to fill vacancies that occur during the recess, whereas the majority opinion by Justice Breyer said, nonsense, those technical restrictions don't apply. The only question is, does the Senate say it's in session or not? And because the Senate said it was in session, the president exceeded his power. Now, that's an example of something that looks technical, but it profoundly affects the way our whole government works. Or in the abortion buffer zone case, four justices said that restrictions of this kind should be subject to the most severe judicial scrutiny because they're really slanted against pro-life speech, especially when they're limited to abortion clinics. And the majority opinion for all nine justices reaching the same result, striking down the Massachusetts law by the Chief Justice, said it's not slanted. It's just that it's not precisely enough tailored. You know, you could protect women and their privacy and their solitude by putting more cops in the area and protecting them from harassment. You don't need to have a kind of no speech zone. Now, those two approaches both led to the same result, but they show you justices who think about the way of reconciling reproductive rights of women and free speech rights of those who want to influence those women against abortion. They think about that in very different ways, and it will mean different things for our future. Mm. Those are just a couple of examples. But
we'll get to more. Go ahead, Professor. Forgive me.
I was just going to say, until you get someone to help you decipher the lingo in which these opinions are sometimes written, you'd kind of just look at the headlines. You know, 9-0 here, 9-0 there. And the 5-4s can be misleading as well.
Yeah. It seems like there's the principal theme in the book, or one of them certainly, is this idea of uncertainty, how the court presents, as you put it, many kinds of uncertainty. I wanted you to talk a little bit about that because that seems surprising, I think, for some of us. But you say writing about the court is not like examining the physical universe. Explain that.
Well, I suppose some physicists who focus on the uncertainty principle would say that at some level, the universe is also uncertain.
Right.
But the point is, we can count the moons of Jupiter or something, but you can't quite count on what the court is going to do next, because when the court renders a decision about abortion or speech or guns, the world reacts, the world changes, the culture changes, and the court, being part of the world and the culture, changes as well. And there are plenty of examples of that in which the court is a moving target because society is a moving target. And a constitution mostly written in 1787 and ratified in 1791 just can't predict very well what the world is going to look like in 2016, 2024. And the court recognizes that uncertainty. Some justices respond to it by saying we ought to move really slowly and cautiously. Other justices say we ought to get ahead of the wave so that change doesn't overtake us. Their whole attitude toward change, toward technology, toward society is invariably reflected in all this stuff, because even though, you know, John Roberts during his confirmation hearings famously said that justices are like umpires, mm-hmm. they just call balls and strikes and they're not supposed to hit or bat, we all know that it's a little more complicated. We all know – well, actually, one famous umpire said even the strike zone is a living, breathing document,
right.
because there are a lot of judgment calls. And justices, unlike umpires, have to make rules because the Constitution is so unspecific on a lot of things.
Explain – I wanted to get a sense of the term, the Roberts Court or the Rehnquist Court or the Burger Court. I mean, because it's a reference obviously to the Chief Justice who's – who presides. But what does that mean practically? Because you point out in the book that chief justices wield little formal power on the court, of course, but they do set a tone.
They set a tone. They decide when they are in the majority, which is quite often, who will write the opinion. It made a big difference that Chief Justice Roberts assigned the two blockbuster opinions this year. The one in the Hobby Lobby case, mm-hmm. and the one dealing with public sector unions in Harris, assigned those to the junior justice in the majority, to Justice Alito, giving him his star turn and his chance to express his philosophy. Whereas Roberts took for himself the remarkably important cell phone decision, which I think is going to be remembered 20, 30 years from now as a turning point in the court's history, the time when the court came to terms with sort of a digital as opposed to analog universe. It's just a matter of convenience, though, that we call the court by the name of the Chief Justice. I mean, right now, a lot of people, because Justice Kennedy wields such influence in the court, he's very often the fifth vote either way, and therefore the deciding vote. Some people say we should call it the Kennedy Court. But as a matter of convention, and without therefore making any special judgments, we call things like the Marshall Court for the early court under the great Chief Justice John Marshall, the Warren Court, the Hughes Court, the Taft Court, Berger, Rehnquist, and so on. That's why it's the Roberts Court.
But how does it reflect, I wonder, if it does in fact, you've got these nine individual jurists, all with a vote. How does the court, or is it, if it does in fact right now, how does it reflect in some way the judicial temperament or character of John Roberts?
Well, his character and his temperament, I think, are infectious in the sense that he's a very affable and friendly guy. But he also, by deciding who will write the opinion, sets the tone. And by deciding sort of how much moral suasion to exert on his colleagues to avoid appearing too disunified, sets the tone. Let me give you a couple of examples. We've had strong chief justices before, people like William Howard Taft, who had been president and knew something about persuasion and sort of arm twisting. And under his court, there were lots of apparently unanimous opinions, even though there was discord under the surface. Then an academic guy comes in, the former dean of Columbia Law School, and when Harlan Fisk Stone of Columbia becomes Chief Justice, he believes in academic freedom. He believes that the people should see all of these differences. So in a way, he tells his colleagues, let it all hang out. You know, don't worry too much about finding a common denominator. And the court swings back and forth partly to reflect what the chief wants to do. Now, there are some chief justices like Warren Burger who don't win the respect of their colleagues. I mean, he, to be really candid, looked like he came from central casting. He had the big head of white hair. He had a gravelly voice. He seemed to exert authority. But he was a little bit out of it on a number of issues, and his colleagues didn't tend to follow his lead. John Roberts is undisputedly brilliant. None of his colleagues, even those who often disagree with him, would doubt that for a moment. He was probably the leading Supreme Court advocate of his generation. And so when he speaks, people listen. So intelligence, character, force of personality, those things make a difference. But ultimately what makes a difference is a gradual process whereby different understandings of the vision that animates the Constitution, how much is it about structure and states' rights and separation of powers? How much is it about human rights and the protection of individuals and of the oppressed? Those underlying emphases make a big difference, partly because they are part of our national dialogue, which never comes to an end. I mean, the great thing is it's an unending conversation, and the Supreme Court plays a huge role in that conversation, even when the rest of the government is broken, paralyzed, when we all know that the other branches can't really get hardly anything done. The court keeps churning out these decisions about same-sex marriage, about gay rights, about the right to vote, about things that affect our everyday lives, about Obamacare, about guns. It is the one branch that you can count on to keep functioning, keep churning out things that make a huge difference. And I really think people should understand better, and they don't need to be lawyers or experts to get it, to get at the understanding, to understand better what makes it tick, what makes the trends, what decides how the court is going to move faster or slower. That was the passion that led me to write this book with this terrific former research assistant of mine.
You know, it's interesting. One of the things you say in the book is that the Roberts Court has already wrought changes in many areas of the law. I mean, it's clearly not settled, the Roberts Court. We're just in the middle of this, or maybe even in the early stages of the Roberts Court. But you do write that the court has forever changed how the Constitution is understood.
I think that's right. It's changed it in many, many ways. It's certainly made a huge impact, I don't think for the better, on the understanding of the relationship between church and state. That is, when it decided in the case called Town of Greece that it's okay to start town meetings where people have to appear, you know, to participate in local government if they want to get a zoning variance or get some benefit. It's not just a legislative session. This is participatory government. The court said it's okay, by a vote of 5-4, it's okay to start those things with sectarian prayers, even though it's going to make some people feel like outsiders, as long as you don't force them to take part. Now, that's a dramatically different vision, even though the court back in the 1980s had said you could start sessions of Congress and of a legislature with a formal prayer. This is a very different vision of the relationship between government and religion than we had before. And in another case, this term, dealing with public sector unions, the court dealt a real blow to the union movement. It's not finished because it said that it hasn't quite decided whether unions that are composed by pure public employees who work full-time for the government are subject to this restraint. But unions that are part-time, that include people like home health care workers who work sort of for the government and sort of for the patient, they are under great threat from rulings of the current court because they cannot require non-union members who benefit from their collective bargaining to chip in their fair share. They can simply take a free ride. And everybody understands that that probably means, given where the court is going, that public sector unions, teachers' unions, police unions, they're going to be bygone. They're going to be in the dustbin of history 5-10 years from now unless the court dramatically changes direction. Now, that might be good. It might be bad. Some people don't think that public employees should be unionized. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about how much impact it will make on our lives, which way that goes.
You know, one of the things you've pointed out in, when you've been discussing the book is that you mentioned, for example, that the court that decided the Brown versus Board of Education ruling didn't have one sitting prior judge on the high court at that time. And you've talked about the kind of life experience that makes a difference in certain kinds of rulings. Now you've got justices, I believe almost all of them went to either Harvard or Yale.
All of them went to Harvard or Yale except for Justice Ginsburg, who transferred to Columbia at the end to get her final degree.
Right.
But that's crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy. What about Brigham Young, the University of Utah, Stanford, Nebraska, Texas? What about UC Berkeley? I mean, there are people from all over the country who have talent to bring. And not only did they all go to Harvard or Yale, but on top of that, they're all former judges or one former solicitor general. They don't have life experience of the sort that the Warren Court did. I mean, the Warren Court had a former attorney general, a former governor, a former head of the Securities and Exchange Commission. Hugo Black was a former senator and, by the way, also, despite his liberalism, a former member of the Ku Klux Klan. Now, I'm not saying we should recruit members of the Ku Klux Klan, but we need diversity of experiences. The fact that there are only 3 women on the court, and I say only, there never have been as many as 3 before, but hey, if we had 9 women, would we regard that as weird? was it weird when there were nine men until Sandra Day O'Connor joined the court? The court is unbalanced in terms of education, background, diversity. I think that we need life experience. Now, why is life experience relevant? Well, the reason is that the Constitution is not like a rule book. It's not like a laundry list. It doesn't give you all the answers. You have to figure out what equality under the law really means or what liberty is all about. And unless you've brought a range of life experiences to that, you're going to answer those questions in a kind of blind, blinkered, tilted, constrained way. And that's why I think it matters to have more diversity on the court.
That's Lawrence Tribe, of course, is a law professor at Harvard Law School, along with Joshua Matz. He co-authored a new book. It's called Uncertain Justice, The Roberts Court and the Constitution. And you can join us if you like, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. When we get back from a break, we'll talk about some of the legal elements that Professor Tribe breaks down in his book, the questions of equality, of health care, of campaign finance. Stay with us. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the acclaimed legal scholar Lawrence Tribe is joining us as we discuss the Supreme Court under Chief Justice John Roberts. Professor Tribe says in some areas the Roberts Court is revising our understanding of the Constitution, and he's written a book to help people understand just how. The analysis goes beyond ideology. Tribe is more interested in how the justices actually think about their work and their positions on the court. It's called Uncertain Justice, The Roberts Court and the Constitution. It was co-written by Joshua Matz. And you can join us again, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. I wanted to talk a little bit about the health care question and what that reveals about the Roberts Court. You mentioned the day of the ruling itself, and I wanted you to say a little bit about that, the morning of this ruling that it was announced. This was June 28th, 2012. Take us through that briefly, if you would, because Chief Justice Roberts gathered the justices into the court's robing room. They all shake hands. There's a kind of a ritual there. Set this up for us.
Well, they all shake hands. They are friendly at a personal level, even when their approaches to law and the Constitution are quite different. Justices Ginsburg and Scalia, for example, go to the opera together. They're real buddies. They're very affable. But there was a palpable tension in the air because everybody knew, since there were no more decision announcement days, that the Supreme Court's decision in this much-awaited case on the fate of the Obama administration's signature domestic attempt or achievement and something that the country had been trying to do for 100 years, broadly ensure closer to more universal health coverage, that was going to come down that very day. And when the Chief Justice said that he had the opinion in the case, of course, the press scrambled. Most people assumed that that meant Obamacare was going down. Mm-hmm. A lot of people eager to get a scoop sort of announced it. It turned out the decision was so complicated, although I think anybody who reads that chapter in this book, and you'll have to tell me, Doug, if you agree, I think maybe you've read it, would understand what those complications were all about. But it was so complicated that every time people would turn the page, they would say, no, it looks like the Obama administration won. Right. No, it looks like they lost. You know, it was very dramatic. There were people running with pages of the opinion to people who were standing in front of the court, in front of the microphones. This was real-time coverage. And, of course, it was misleading coverage. At one point, across the Capitol, Barack Obama, waiting anxiously in his office, is told by Catherine Rumler, his chief of staff, even before that happens, he gets
CNN
news. Yeah, he hears on CNN from my friend and former student with whom I actually had dinner last night, Jeff Toobin.
No.
great guy, very good journalist. But, you know, you can't always get it right. He said that that Obamacare had gone down. Actually, he was in some ways more right than many people seem to realize, but that's another story that maybe we won't have time to go into. But that was a shock to the president, because the president had been told by Nancy Pelosi, by everybody, that, you know, this constitutional attack, emotional though it was, just didn't have wings. It was not going to fly. It was going to crash.
Yeah.
And so it really seemed shocking to him that the law had been struck down.
You say that people were surprised by Justice Roberts' vote. Of course, they were surprised. But you seem to suggest in the book that the way people have interpreted that decision is misunderstood, because you say his opinion reveals, here's how you put it, a desire to limit the scope of federal power and to craft a new constitutional law in order to do so. That seems crucial.
That's right. And basically, a lot of people said that Roberts was originally going to vote with what they like to call the conservatives, with people like Scalia and Alito and Kennedy and Thomas, and that he somehow changed his vote, must have knifed them in the side. He became a traitor to the cause. Other people said, no, he's a tactical genius. He's violating his own principles by upholding the individual mandate in order to build up capital so he can, you know, strike down equality laws later on. It was all, you know, a lot of it's just made up stuff. If you know how Roberts is thinking about this stuff, and I thought I did, and especially if you pay attention to the oral arguments, and I did, you would predict, as I did publicly on the air both before and after the oral argument, that Roberts would deliver the decisive vote upholding the mandate, but not as an exercise of Congress's power to regulate commerce, to regulate the economy, only as an exercise of the much more conservative power of Congress to jack up your tax liability, your income tax liability a bit, to offset the costs that you're going to impose on the system as a free rider by not getting coverage when you show up to the emergency room and end up getting free care and so forth. It seemed to me that he was looking for a way to say that this law is a mandate in name only. It's not really all that coercive. It just says you have a choice. Either you buy insurance that qualifies under the Affordable Care Act, or if you choose not to, then you pay a higher income tax, and it's enforced entirely by the IRS, and you're not threatened with imprisonment. And you're not made into an outlaw if you don't buy the insurance. And he had the cooperation of the lawyer representing the Obama administration in viewing it that way. It's basically just a social responsibility payment. And it had conservative origins. It came from the Heritage think tank and from the brain of Newt Gingrich. This wasn't a radical single-payer plan. It wasn't government-run healthcare. It wasn't socialism. And most crucially for Roberts, it was not a national police power, not a kind of national assertion of power to regulate all of life. It was just an adjustment in your tax liability. And that's what I thought Roberts would do, and that's exactly what he did.
I wonder, you say you believe that the ruling reveals a kind of uncertainty, there's that word again, about the best way forward. And you say it left this kind of unmistakable message that there is change, as you put it, on the horizon. But you don't believe it will be extreme change in the sense that we're talking about economic liberty now. Some worry the court is going to sort of go back to the and bust many of the old, you know, New Deal regulations, that there's going to be this kind of pre-1930s world. You think change is coming, but you don't think it's quite that extreme.
You know, well, the uncertainty relates to the speed with which it's coming and the fact that the composition of the court in 2 years, 5 years, 10 years can't be predicted now because we don't know which presidents will be making nominations. We don't know which senates will be deciding whether to confirm or filibuster or vote someone down. We don't know how seriously the electorate will take these things. If enough people read my book, I bet they'll take it more seriously. But those are things we don't know. We do know that the court is troubled by intrusions on personal liberty, and that includes economic liberty. We know that even Justice Sotomayor, in a case involving drug price regulation from Vermont, joined with justices who are normally thought of as very conservative, like Scalia and Thomas and Alito and Kennedy, she joined with them to strike down that regulation because it controlled the flow of information. It's kind of using the First Amendment in order to deregulate. And Justices Breyer and some of those of a similar disposition about what a terrible mistake the Supreme Court had made when it restricted the power of government at all levels to protect workers and consumers back in the 1920s and 30s. He dissented furiously, saying that you're turning the clock back to that era. Well, you know, Justice Sotomayor might have second thoughts about where she's going and how fast. She's proven herself to be a very adept and brilliant jurist. We don't know what her trajectory will look like. We don't know a lot of things. But we do know that the court is moving somewhat cautiously in a direction of protecting economic liberty more broadly, and certainly in a direction of restricting national regulatory power more broadly.
Yeah.
So that the decision in the Obamacare case sort of tells us a lot about direction, but it doesn't answer all our questions.
Well, the book came out before the Hobby Lobby decision came down, the Burwell versus Hobby Lobby case. I wonder, this, of course, is the latest in the federal litigation related to the Affordable Care Act. It's this question of whether private businesses owned by, you know, people with religious precepts are exempt from the contraception mandate in the Affordable Care Act. What did you make about that ruling? And in particular, because you say in your book, pay attention to these opinions, what do you make about that very spirited dissent by Justice Ginsburg?
Well, I thought Justice Ginsburg was right, frankly. I'm terribly worried about the direction that the Hobby Lobby decision represents. It wasn't technically a decision about the Constitution at all. It was a decision about an overwhelmingly bipartisan law that Congress had passed called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which said that when any person can show that a neutral general law like Obamacare or like a ban on the use of drugs or anything imposes a substantial burden on that person's exercise of religious freedom, then the government has to show why it cannot exempt the person, and that means show a compelling justification for disregarding the person's religious objections, or show that there is no less restrictive way of accommodating those objections. Now, that sounds rather technical, but the bottom line is, can people become, or can corporations, which the Religious Freedom Restoration Act apparently included in its definition of persons, can they become a law unto themselves and impose their views on their employees or their students, as in the case of Wheaton College? The real issue in that case is, how did it really impinge on the Green family? That was the family that owned Hobby Lobby, basically. It was a closely held corporation. How did it impinge on their free exercise of religion that they had to indirectly support? And they're now arguing that it would be bad even if all they had to do was facilitate government support, that they had to indirectly support the use of contraceptions by their employees or, in the case of colleges, by their students in ways that violate their beliefs. Typically, you don't have the right to impose your beliefs on third parties. So it's a very dramatic decision. It would take a long time to summarize the dissent, but my own bottom line is, I think the court was moving in a scary direction in that case.
We'll have to sort of summarize a chapter that you wrote about equality. I was really interested in what you had to say about Justice Clarence Thomas. In a particular case you write about, this was a case related to equality and race. And in this particular case, he wrote—
And affirmative action.
That's right. And he wrote an opinion, as he often does, or sometimes does anyway. He wrote separately. And you say this, which I think some people may be surprised by. You write that even those who don't agree with Justice Thomas cannot deny that the court has benefited from his string of solo opinions. Give us your sense of Clarence Thomas, because a lot of people think when he just sort of sits there mute in the oral arguments phase that he doesn't have anything to say or doesn't have anything to contribute. But your sense is a lot more complicated, obviously, than that.
Well, partly because I know him and I've talked to him. He really does have a very brilliant mind. I mean, he's a very smart guy. The reason he doesn't talk, he says, it's because his parents brought him up and his grandparents brought him up to think that when people are talking, you should listen.
Right.
I don't know if that's the whole story.
Yeah.
But whatever the reason for his silence at oral argument and for his act looking sort of like a sphinx sitting at oral argument, it's sure not that he doesn't have plenty of ideas, and it's not that he doesn't know the cases. He knows them inside and out. You just have to talk to his law clerks after they've served with him to know how rigorously he prepares and how well he understands the cases. But what they've learned from him is the different ways that people experience their racial background. I mean, there's this wonderful contrast in the court between Sonia Sotomayor and Clarence Thomas, both of which recognize and are quite open about it that they have been the beneficiaries of race-sensitive affirmative action. For Clarence Thomas, it has a really poignant meaning. He says, look, don't do us any favors. You think you're being kind to us, you white guys, when you put a thumb on the scale because we're minorities. But what you do is you stamp us with a badge of inferiority. It follows us all our lives. No matter how well I did at Yale, everybody still said, that's the guy, you know, he's an affirmative action baby. No matter how bright my opinions are, they'll always say, oh, yeah, Clarence Thomas, he got there because he's black. And that stigma is unfair to impose. And he quotes early leaders of the civil rights movement saying, you know, beware of white majorities bringing gifts.
Yeah.
They may mean well, but they may be hurting you unintentionally. And Sonia Sotomayor also says, look, I know I've been the beneficiary of affirmative action, but it doesn't stamp me with any mark of inferiority. I don't have to look at the glass as half empty. I see it as half full. It gave me great opportunities. I want other people to have those opportunities. She's equally passionate in describing it. And without those two voices, it all is reduced to some abstract legalistic dispute over whether equality means never paying attention to race, as Chief Justice Roberts seems to say and several other members of the court say, or whether equality means making sure that racial minorities don't get subjugated and held back. That's an interesting dispute about our history, about the meaning of language, but it only comes to life when you have these voices expressing their own experience. That's why Thurgood Marshall always used to say that until he was on the court, most of his colleagues had never really gotten to know an African American. It was why Sandra Day O'Connor made such a difference on the court. None of her colleagues understood what it meant to be a woman and the way a woman is treated in our society. Those experiences bring the court to life and bring to life ideas in the Constitution that would otherwise be inert.
It's Lawrence Tribe, law professor at Harvard Law School, along with Joshua Matz. He co-authored the new book, Uncertain Justice, The Roberts Court and the Constitution. We'll take a few of your calls when we get back from a break. Our number, 801-585-9378. That's 801-585-WEST. Or you can send us an email, radiowest@kuer.org. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with legal scholar Lawrence Tribe. We're talking about his book, Uncertain Justice, The Roberts Court and the Constitution. It was co-written along with Joshua Matz. He's joining us. Professor Tribe is today from a studio in New York City. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Let's go to the phones. Tim is with us in Salt Lake City. Tim, sorry for the wait. Welcome.
Well, thank you. My question is, it seems to me that the modern-day justices are serving for 20 and 30 years. Has that been the case throughout history, or are they really serving more than they for a longer terms than they have in the past?
I think the answer, Tim, is that they are serving longer because people are living longer.
Yeah.
And people are now being appointed at younger ages, partly because more people, including more presidents and more senators, have come to realize what a massive impact they can make on our lives. They're dealing with the fabric of everyday life. So presidents want to leave a legacy, and they want people to be there through many presidencies. And the original design of the Constitution, when people, to be blunt about it, died off younger, didn't contemplate that life tenure, which is designed to keep the justices independent of the political forces that got them there and of any possible forces that might keep them there, you know, those original purposes don't require what we now have. And that's why I've been at least toying with the idea of 18-year non-renewable fixed terms, staggered in such a way that each president in one term ends up getting an average of two appointments, so that the court does not get so out of touch with contemporary culture. Right now, to be in touch with modern life, many of the justices have to lean rather heavily on their young law clerks. I mean, Justice Kagan learned how to use Mortal Kombat from her law clerks because, says, you know, there was a case about violent interactive video games and she wanted to know what it's all about. The court has become very tech savvy. I mean, their opinion about cell phones, which was, you know, remarkably familiar with Faraday bags and with encryption and with all sorts of modern technology. Roberts talked about how the phrase, there's an app for that, has now become part of the lexicon to the point where it's sort of the answer to improving your love life as well as your prayer options. They catch up, but they catch up partly with the help of people generations younger than them. And I do think there's a lot to be said for cutting off their service after a period like 18 years, as long as they're not running for re-election, as long as they're term limited and can't be reappointed and therefore don't have to worry about pleasing whoever will be in the Oval Office when their term ends.
Tim, thanks for the call. 801-585-WEST, again the number. Doug is with us in Los Angeles. Doug, welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is, do the justices collaborate and discuss the cases before they make their decisions? And the reason I'm asking that is you typically find the same agreements amongst the conservatives and the liberals, and I'm just wondering why there isn't more of a mix amongst the justices on different decisions. So I was thinking they'd probably get together and talk about it and decide to vote as a group. Am I wrong, or does that occur?
Let me make sure you could understand that, Lawrence Tribe. It's not a great phone line. Did you understand the question?
Yeah, I understood. And I'll try, in case any of the listeners didn't, I'll just repeat the basic idea. Doug wants to know how much collaboration and discussion there is within the court before they come out with their decisions, and whether the absence, whether they kind of put their heads together, and that maybe explains how often like-minded justices come out the same way. You see so often the same alignment. Well, number one, the surprising thing is that you don't see the same alignment as often as the press would have you believe. There are plenty of cases where Alito and Scalia disagree, where Scalia is more protective of privacy than Breyer, where Breyer and Sotomayor don't agree. There are plenty of those. But the reason you often see cases where they agree is that they often have similar underlying philosophies of what the world is about, what the Constitution is for, and that's not all that surprising. I mean, elections have consequences, and presidents name justices, and the philosophy of a justice is likely not to be wildly different from that of a kind of political coalition that helped the justice get into power. Now, to answer your question about collaboration and discussion, there is some, but not as much as many people would want. The justices communicate with one another almost like nine little law firms. They shoot memos back and forth. They don't have much discussion. They have almost no discussion, either in little conclaves or as a group of nine, before a case is argued. The first time they really discuss a case is after they've read the briefs, when they're up on the bench, and when some lawyer is arguing in front of them. That's why they ask questions that use the lawyer often as kind of chum or bait. They kind of bounce questions off the lawyer to talk to one another. There's a lot of station identification. And they are often asking a question just rhetorically so that their colleagues will know what bothers them most about one or another position. Then after the argument, there is a good bit of discussion in the conference when they vote. But there is not, or almost never, are there cliques of justices who put their heads together and say, you know, let's form a block on this one and let's go in this direction together.
You know, it's interesting. You write along that line. You say the court, for example, related to privacy. You've talked about the fact that there's not really a left-right commitment on the court in terms of its sensibilities about privacy. You've mentioned Sotomayor and Scalia, for example. They're on the same side in this issue, even though they have different approaches. And Breyer, you've mentioned, is to the right of Scalia on this matter of privacy.
That's right. There are many cases where Breyer says this search or that stop was perfectly okay, but Scalia disagrees. There was a case involving the cases, for example, in which Scalia would have been very protective of privacy were a case about thermal imaging where the government can tell if you're growing weed in your house by seeing what the heat patterns are on your wall, a case about dog sniffing, a case about DNA sampling of armed suspects, a case about stopping cars based on anonymous tips, a case on things like that. In almost every one of those cases, in every one of those cases, Justice Scalia goes with privacy and against the government. And in just about all of them, Breyer is with the government and against the privacy claim. Now, not because Justice Breyer doesn't like his privacy as much as the next guy. It's just because they have different approaches to the balance between privacy and security. But people are deeply misled if they think that just because a justice like Scalia is a, quote, conservative, unquote, that you can't count on him to protect human rights in various cases. Sometimes in cases where it's obvious he doesn't like the result, he voted for the flag burners, even though he said, in my private world, I'd just as soon get rid of them all. But he thought they were expressing freedom of speech.
Thanks very much, by the way, Tim. And Doug, 801-585 West, again, the number to join us. I want to come to this. You write a whole chapter about the campaign finance question, and the Citizens United case, of course, which is a case, of course, that's been roundly criticized, portrayed as this deadly threat to America's experiment with democracy. But you say the truth, as usual, is more complicated. And you write this in the book. You write that it's easy to lose sight of the fact that Citizens United posed incredibly difficult questions about free speech and popular sovereignty and political equality. So it's a complicated decision, a controversial one. But what do you make of that decision?
Well, if I could answer you in the minute or so we have, then nobody would need to read the chapter. But bottom line, I think the court was deeply misunderstood. Basically, the way I start writing about it is to talk about this big battle between two of the most powerful institutions in America, the Supreme Court of the United States and Stephen Colbert,
right?
In which the court basically brought knives to a gunfight. Colbert had all the ammunition. He could make fun of the court. He could run circles around it. He could make it look like the court didn't know the difference between a corporation and a human being, that it didn't know the difference between speech and money. That's not what it was about. The court certainly knows that corporations, though they are run by people and owned by people, aren't people, although technically they may be a person within the meaning of various texts like the Constitution. But that wasn't the basis of the decision. The basis of the decision was that it's dangerous to First Amendment values to give the government the power to decide who or what may speak, how much, and may spend how much amplifying their speech, whether it's a corporation or an alien, whether it's a sort of a spaceship or something else. The key isn't who the speaker is. The key is the speech and the rights of the listener. And the court was saying, we don't really trust the government. The First Amendment has taught us not to trust the government. I wish they kept that in mind in some of the cases where they trust the government too much. But they're saying, we don't trust the very people that you guys think are bought and paid for to write the rules that will govern how much their opponents can spend to unseat them. These rules may look cool, but they may be just an incumbent protection act. That's what Citizens United was about. Now, on the other hand, I think the court wasn't as candid as it should have been about how troublesome it is that money has such a big influence over access. Mm. You get your phone calls returned. The court should have been more candid about admitting that.
You know, it's interesting. You write this, though.
Yeah,
I just wanted to bring this point up because you mentioned that even painstakingly narrow rulings can generate unintended social and political consequences, that in fact the justices sometimes even surprise themselves, the effects of their decisions. Do you think that's what happened in this case?
Well, I don't think that they predicted that it would have such massive social impact, partly because what they were technically doing was so narrow. Even before Citizens United, the very same corporations could have spent exactly the same amounts for and against these candidates as long as they avoided actually coming out and favoring one or another candidate. And the court thought that because Citizens United simply dealt with a minor wrinkle in that already pockmarked scheme, mm-hmm. that people would not think it was such a big deal. They didn't count on Stephen Colbert. They didn't count on President Obama making such a huge point about it in his State of the Union message. They often don't count. When they decided Roe v. Wade, they didn't know that they were going to spark a social revolution. They thought they were deciding something about a medical procedure, right? The court often doesn't quite estimate what effects its decisions will have. And sometimes the decisions have very surprising effects. I mean, when the court finally holds that no state can deprive people of the right to marry just because they are of the same sex, and I'm confident that that will be what the court holds within the next couple of years,
right.
I don't think the sky will fall the way a lot of people predict. I think people will by then have gotten used to the fact that, you know, their relatives, their friends, they know more people that are out as gay people. Their heterosexual marriages aren't going to be hurt by gay marriage. So there's a lot of unexpected development after a decision. Sometimes a decision doesn't shake the world as much as the court assumes it might. Sometimes it shakes it more.
It's Lawrence Tribe. He's a law professor, of course, at Harvard Law School, along with Joshua Matz, co-authored a new book called Uncertain Justice, The Roberts Court and the Constitution. He joined us from a studio in New York City. Lawrence Tribe, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you, Doug. It's been a great pleasure.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. I should point out we've just posted a new feature to Video West. It's a short film from Utah filmmaker M.P. Cunningham. It's a profile of a woman named Alex, and Cunningham describes her as a stalker photographer. She takes pictures of people in their homes through their windows when they're not looking. Go have a look. Let us know what you think. VideoWest.KUER.org. Radio West, produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.